I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Nick and Jack and everybody here at Los Alamos for the privilege of attending this gathering. This whole problem of contemporary history, of oral history, is a rather difficult one and a very interesting one. I noticed the recent issue of Saturday Review had as its lead kind of theme the writing of what they call hot history. And in one of the articles, may have been the lead article, there was a paraphrase of a very famous statement that I would like to start with. That gentleman said that perhaps the writing of history is too important to leave to the professional historians. That's a paraphrase on the famous Clausewitz statement about generals. Ever since Nick and Jack asked me to be a part of this conference, I really wondered, you know, where I belonged and what I had to say and add in terms, in relation to all of the pioneers and the people who were actually the creators of what we now call the computer revolution, which is still an ongoing revolution. I suddenly realized, as I thought about it, and particularly as I've sat here the last few days, that the Computer History Project is itself a historical object at the moment. You know, like the early computers, the dinosaurs, the project too has been relegated to museum status. And maybe like these same dinosaurs, in some future date, it'll be resurrected, or perhaps it'll be reincarnated in some new form. The project at the Smithsonian was originally started officially, I think, with a contract signed in 1967. The origins of it are much too complicated to go into. Cuthbert Hurd, Isaac Auerbach were among the individuals who conceived the idea of what they called preserving the history of computing. They felt that we had a golden opportunity, an opportunity to preserve the history with the original cast, and that it would be most unfortunate if we let this opportunity go by. I joined the project in the spring of 1971. Again, I don't want to go into what I inherited and the state of the project at that time, but the advisory committee that I had, Isaac Auerbach was on that committee, Cuthbert Hurd, Walter Carlson, the chief historian of the Secretary of Defense, Rudy Winokur, a couple of senior scholars at the Smithsonian, and I had thought long and hard about you know, how one does something like this, trying to, what Ken May, I guess, would talked about Monday, the problem of creating a historiographic model for a contemporary period where I was going to be dealing with the problem of recording information with the individuals who had been part of that process, at the same time collecting the documentation, trying to locate things which had been lost, trying to identify things that perhaps people had forgotten. The whole problem of structure, of the kinds of preparation, the kinds of homework I had to do, and I got to thinking about the history of mathematics, which is the area I know best, and how various histories of mathematics are written. And as Ken May has pointed out, there are a variety of ways of doing it. What we really try to do is take kind of extreme positions and find a linear combination of them and come up with something that we can live with. As I look back on the model that I came up with, I realize that I was doing something Philip Davis identified in a talk at the Mathematical Society meetings last January in San Antonio. I was really doing what he called, I was taking a Jamesian approach to history. In an essay entitled Great Men and Their Environment, the American philosopher William James says, and I quote, "The community stagnates without the impulse of the individual. the impulse does away, the impulse dies away without the sympathy of the community. I think perhaps maybe I even read that again. The community stagnates without the impulse of the individual. The impulse dies away without the sympathy of the community. And as I got into my research and talking to people, I realized the tremendous importance of what I'll broadly call the environment. And that takes in a lot of things. Not only what it was like to work on these projects, but things like what were the needs, what were the pressures involved, what were the motivations, what were the kinds of backgrounds that individuals brought to these projects, and as they moved on to other endeavors, what kinds of things did they take with them? What was the prevailing technology? What were the attitudes about the technology? What was in the air? We're seeing what appears to be, as we look at the history of the last 40 years, a kind of simultaneity. And as I tried to design this project, as I said, I had a lot of help. I knew fairly early on I didn't want to do a computer tree. And I didn't want to do a total great man approach. And I guess I started, and my thinking started, with a large chart that Perry Crawford had prepared for me. It's kind of a time scale. To the right? Okay. And started at 1900 and ran across to, oh, roughly 1960. And on this, he had put a number of, we'll call it events, a machine. I'll put whirlwind on because that was kind of an interesting thing. And the time frame was crude, roughly when it started or was conceived, when the project began and when it ended. And then I proceeded to try to find the various individuals that were associated with it to give me some kind of a link, some kind of a tie. But this importance of all these other dimensions kept coming back to me. There was another problem that people like Cuthbert Hurd and Isaac impressed on me, and that was that there had to be some priorities, that some of the individuals were getting on in years, some of them were rather young, and the priorities had nothing to do so much with the dates of the events as they did with the state of the individual. A classic example, I guess, is the late Howard Aiken. I can remember now almost my first meeting being given two priorities as absolute number one: Vannevar Bush and Howard Aiken. I didn't succeed in interviewing Vannevar Bush because of reasons of his health, although we had a number of appointments. Howard Aiken was another story. He was active, obviously. I could find his tracks everywhere, including a patent that I got a copy of that he did in either late 71 or early 72. But every time I called him, he kept saying, "I'm too busy." In the meantime, I interviewed everybody that I could find associated with him during the years at Harvard. And I kept calling and I kept trying. And as he kept rejecting me, I kept being a little more insistent and less polite. And one of my more impolite phone calls, he finally said, "Sure, you can come down." And I said, "When?" He said, "Tomorrow, if you want." So I set up the earliest possible date, and it was an incredible experience. I had the good fortune to get him to agree to allow Professor Kong from Harvard to join me, and we spent three or four very intensive days working with him. His health was really fantastic. He was very active, consulting for Monsanto Chemical. The two of us went for walks in the evening, and both Professor Kong and I felt that this first interview ought to be rather a broad brushstroke, and that we wouldn't worry about a lot of specifics, because obviously he was a man in excellent health and going strong, and he was now agreeable to talking to us, and we would see him continually over the next year and gradually zero in on the topics that we wanted to talk about and get more and more detail. Now, of course, everybody knows that on March the 14th, which was about 3 weeks after this interview, Howard Aiken, on a consulting trip to St. Louis, had a heart attack and died. So I, you know, the priorities that people like Hurd and Auerbach gave me were very, very important. Wasn't all the information wasn't gone. For example, a comment was made in one of the early talks about Aiken. It seemed to be a general feeling that Howard Aiken dragged his feet about going from electromechanical to electronic. And I asked him rather specifically about this. Anybody who knows Howard Aiken knows that the best way to relate to him was to be direct and not beat around the bush. And so I asked questions which to other people might be hard to ask or rather embarrassing, where you have to kind of skirt around. But in Aiken's case, everything was blunt, direct. And I said, you know, okay, Howard, you've been accused of a lot of things, and one of them is really dragging your feet on going electronic. Do you want to go on the record in that respect? And he said, no, I knew that was the way to go. I didn't want to bother with technology. I didn't want to have to worry about reliability of components that were unfamiliar and untried. As soon as I saw these other projects going and running, and I saw that the engineers had solved the problem of applying the technology to this particular area, then I went electronic instantly. And I think the record bears that out if one looks at the date of the Harvard Mark III. I think the best example, best way to show you at least a piece of how we operated or attempted to operate is to take one instance, and I've chosen a gentleman who hasn't been mentioned here, Professor George Stibitz, and the Bell Relay machines. I guess I want to start with Model K is my beginning point. This is approximately 1937. To begin with, I arranged my interview with Professor Stibitz, and anybody who knows him knows he's an extremely cooperative gentleman. And I got him to work out with me one of these large time-oriented charts of this nature, in which we started with the Model K, Mod 1, all the way through Mod 6, got them on a relative time scale, all of which could be checked later, so the accuracy wasn't important, and then tried to get onto this chart, which was really a long sheet out of a computer printout. It was the back part of it. So we had a long strip of paper, even slightly longer than I can stretch my arms. And then we started to put on this things like needs, motivation, pressures, current technology, significant events that may or may not have affected his thinking as the years evolved, things like Claude Shannon's paper, Turing's paper, events that were around that we now recognize as important, at least intellectual milestones. And so we started then with Model K in this vein. I'm sure some of you have seen this. These models are all renamed. So I said, where did you begin? Well, as Stibitz put it, he began one night sitting around his kitchen, which is where the K comes from. This is the kitchen computer. And he had been thinking, he'd been doing work on relays, research, and said it suddenly struck him that one ought to be able to do binary arithmetic with relays. And so he had a few relays that he was playing with at home, and he got a little 1 foot square piece of wood out of his shop, and he put a couple of relays on it and discovered that he could add one-digit binary numbers with relays. And he took this then to the laboratory the next morning and showed it to few people there, and they said, you know, that's really interesting. At this point, I interjected and said, hey, let's stop a minute. What made you think about binary addition? And he said, oh, I don't know. I just had kind of always known about it. I studied my algebra from Crystal, and Crystal has a section on binary algebra, Boolean algebra. And so I thought about this, and then I thought, well, we have some problems at the laboratory. One of the problems is our computers doing calculations involving complex numbers. They have to add and subtract and multiply and divide A plus BI, C plus DI. in order to do circuit design, circuit analysis. And of course, you know that I'm using the word computer in the, at least dictionary-wise, pre-1956 sense. The computer is a human being, not an object. And it's been referred to earlier, and there were the computers were a group of young women, each of whom had operations to do on these complex numbers until finally, at the end of the computational chain, the results came out, various checking spaces in between. And so they thought about the fact of whether or not they could mechanize this operation in this binary mode. And the complex calculator, Belmod 1, was a result of that. I mean, there was a calculator designed to meet a specific need that was going on in the laboratory. Another rather interesting bit of information that came out at this time that I have yet to have refuted, Professor Stibitz said that when they finally got the design and got this thing so they knew it would work, he went to the powers that be at Bell Laboratories, and this is pre-1940, and said, you know, gentlemen, I think for $50,000 I can build you a general purpose relay calculator. And the general response was, gee, who wants to spend $50,000 just to do calculations? You know, again, and many of you know this, we realized that there were, we had the capability to do electronic calculation or relay or electromechanical calculation long before these things came into being. I think you could conjecture as you look at the Babbage papers about our capability, and you don't have to even look at the Babbage papers, just look at the Jacquard loom, our capability to do calculations with some motive power like steam. It's really not a very big jump, but that requires a feeling somewhere of a need to do it and an environment in which that support can be attained. The complex calculator is interesting. It has some interesting stories. They were so delighted with it that they wanted to show it to everybody. And there was a mathematical meeting scheduled for Dartmouth College. I think it was the summer, either August or September of 1940. And so their original plans were to take the complex calculator to Dartmouth and demonstrate it. And I should mention that the complex calculator was unique in many ways. One of the ways in which it was unique, Bell Laboratories at that time was in New York City on, I think, West Avenue. Right. I remember seeing the building once on the tour going around Manhattan Island. You can see it from the boat, and it was pointed out. And the complex calculator, I was told, was kept in a closet. And the only ones who could get to that closet were the maintenance men and the janitors. And then you had these external units to get onto the calculator, but only one person at a time could operate. Anyway, Stibitz was scheduled to give this talk with the complex calculator at Dartmouth. And he had written the talk, and somewhere in June or July, the decision was made, no, we don't want to move this thing to Dartmouth. That's going to really be a lot of trouble, and that it really was a lot easier to just set up a teletype terminal at Dartmouth in the hallway outside of one of the lecture halls, and that Stibitz could give his talk, and then people could play around with this thing. And so that's exactly what was done. The complex calculator stayed in New York City, teletype input and output at Dartmouth College, so everybody got a first-hand demonstration. John Mockley told me a story about that I'll repeat, and if I'm wrong, he can fill it in or elaborate later. But he attended that particular meeting, and he remembers wandering through the hall during one of the sessions that he wasn't attending and seeing this little gentleman playing around with the machine and getting more and more frustrated. And I can't remember whether John asked him why he was getting frustrated or not, but he did find out that the frustration was due to the fact that he was trying to get this thing to divide by zero and it just wouldn't do it. Stibitz was too good a mathematician. And he later found out that the gentleman was a man named Norbert Wiener. How am I doing on time, Bill? Okay. Um, I think possibly because of the, I really want to give a lot of time to Brian Randall. I'm going to close, and I think I'll close with a comment that I made in response to Professor Burkhoff, and when he asked when this history was going to be written, and I responded with the von Neumann constant, which was 3 years. That seemed to be, if you ask von Neumann when the IAS machine was going to be completed, he said 1 month or 18 months or whatever it was, and that became known as the von Neumann constant. In England, this was known as the Hartree constant. Whenever you asked Hartree when something was going to be done, you got a fixed date, regardless of when you asked. I think that's a good place to close and respond to a few questions before Brian Randall begins. Oh, excuse me, Bill, I have one more. This is like an announcement. I just got a thing in the mail that just came off the press that some of you have seen perhaps, but I wanted to put it outside where you could look at it, but please don't take it. The Encyclopedia of Computer Science, which has a portion of it devoted to history. And there are biographical sketches of a number of individuals. There are machine descriptions. Many individuals in this room are both in the volume and have also contributed to the volume. And I haven't had a chance to look at it, so I won't comment any further on its quality or anything else. In fact, I haven't seen my paper for 4 years, so I don't remember what it was anymore.
Jack Howlett, Jack Howlett, I really must correct that last statement in memory of Hartree. What Hartree said was not, you know, it wasn't quite as you said, actually. Hartree said that when you ask anybody who's making a computer when it will be finished, the answer is in 1 month or 6 months or something. You know, and that number is constant.
The reverse of the very different kind of constant then.
Question in the rear.
Donald Cardwell, Manchester, England. May I put in a brief plea for the preservation of hardware? It seems to me, as a historian of science and technology, that my discipline tends to be just a little too bookish. Now, if we preserve hardware, I think we can do it for two reasons. First of all, the intrinsic interest as a relic of the past. And secondly, the fact that later generations can learn something about the way we do things, the way we've done things. We can't be sure of this ourselves. It's for later generations to interpret. Now, in our Science Museum in Manchester, we've adopted a policy of developing and studying the past through working models, through working artifacts, and we've learnt a lot that you won't find in books. The reason being that the record in technology is not a written one. Very often, it's usually a verbal or a tacit one. So can I suggest that we pay attention to the preservation of important relics in hardware? Thank you.
I'd like to respond to that and, of course, echo the same thing. When I talk to people, I try to collect documents primarily. But because I was told at the Smithsonian that I really had no responsibility for hardware, but I was also sensitive to that, I learned something in Project Whirlwind about the collection of hardware. Bob Everett only told a small part of the frustration of getting Whirlwind ultimately into the Smithsonian, which I agree with you is incredibly important. In looking at Whirlwind and some of its accompanying blueprints, which I think are important to have along with the hardware itself, Ken McVicker, who was doing some work for me, discovered that the blueprints, to be comprehensible to today's generation, would have to be redone because the IEEE standards came long after those were written, and people who have been trained in the last two or two and a half decades can't read these blueprints. And I think that's an important thing to keep in mind.
Can I come back on that just very briefly? We've found in our experiences that archivists are very excellent people, but they tend to be much more expert in legal and literary matters than in scientific and technical ones. They can't read circuit diagrams or engineering drawings. That's one problem. I would like to make just one brief remark too about, well, I'll say for convenience, 9 years ago, the then bursar of Manchester University, Mr. Rainford, asked me casually, quite casually, whether we could use or preserve the Hartree differential analyzer. And I said, of course, yes. We hadn't the money to move it. We hadn't the space to accommodate it. Well, the space problem solved itself, fortunately. And the money, well, that appeared in a different item of university expenditure. But it's a very casual way, I think, of preserving important historical relics.
Right. It's very
I feel this is a very urgent point, and I do hope that if there are proposals emanating from this conference, that some statement of the importance of preserving hardware will be made. Thank you.
Yeah, it seems so obvious, and I think that's why nobody has made the statement. The computer history is unique in that each of these dinosaurs, as I put the early ones, vanish as soon as they're superseded. It's just like why we don't have any Greek geometry before Euclid. As soon as the next generation comes in, the previous generation vanishes. The dinosaur is buried, and it's very important to keep these.
And one last point.
Please, we're on a very rigid time schedule. One very short question, right here.
Well, you now embarrass me. It was a comment. In the summer of 1957, I was a computer, and I was not a young woman. This was, however, second shift, and in the fine tradition of the business, that was a 12 cents an hour differential.
Well, I think one of the big computer projects of the 30s was the WPA project that somebody referred to in a loft in New York City. That needs to be written up. Sometime.
You did such a fine job of making it short, but I think we have time to let Ken May.
A very short comment. I'm heartily in favor of preserving artifacts, and if one can't preserve a whole computer, maybe one can preserve some unique part of it, which may be enough. But one of the big points I think that should become clear here is that we should try not to let the historic record of this period depend only on these artifacts. We need also descriptions, careful descriptions, which might not always just automatically be available. It's necessary for someone to take the trouble to describe how things are done, and I hope that too will be.
The part of the project that was the longest and biggest was the one I didn't. The oral history interviews, their transcription, their documentation, the associated manuals, the machine descriptions, engineering notebooks, later indexing of these materials. My Jamesian dream was to create this kind of a research archive that included the whole spectrum.
I'm sorry, we are...
Yes, I think this...
Okay. Well, one more.
Pamela McCordick, the University of Pittsburgh. How accessible is this material now?
I don't know. As I said, Bill may be able to answer that. I haven't been able to get back to it.
Okay. I think that I will not take the time to answer that. The answer is, it is not very accessible. Under certain circumstances, you can get bits and pieces of it, but the Smithsonian has custody of the material. It is not being lost, but it is not readily accessible. Your best bet is to go to the Smithsonian and ask. Under most circumstances, the answer will be no, but it never hurts to ask.